He's host. He's a speaks. No. All right. So, at least if you're in the room, please be quiet. Is that turned on? Yeah. At least if you're in the room, be quiet. We're gonna speak to whoever wants to hear us, or can hear us. All right. Now. Look, a lot of what we're going to present, the fortunate thing about this is that afterwards we're going to view the stars, and hopefully Scott will be leading that, so it's not just kind of just a rant about astronomy here. But look, there's what was just laid out kind of gave a really good foundation for this discussion. It actually saved us a lot of time. Because now we don't have to explain terms. It was like a very good Euclidean book of vitamins. Everyone defined it. Hopefully, people took notes and can recall everything that was rigorously, I guess you can say, constructed, not defined. But look, we're going to start off with this Plato dialogue to get into this discussion, because there was a reference to the 50 years paper, and they discussed the development of orbs in the sky and now the development of humanity, and obviously, well, maybe not obviously to everyone, the development of humanity involves personalities, it involves different interactions, you know, it's not like it's just turtles that have interactions with each other. Human beings are probably one of the most important interactions in that universe. And look, Mr. LaRouche made it clear in that paper, in the next 50 years, very, very specific points that we want to introduce. And If people by any chance are confused by the presentation, you know, you can take it up with me afterwards, and Scott and Sylvia. But we do want to hopefully get out and see the stars. But look, we're going to start with this Plato dialogue to introduce this panel, and it's a discussion in the Republic. And Socrates is in a discussion with some people about who should actually run the state. And one of the problems that occurs is that, you know, the person that is most qualified to run the state, people just hate. You know, they can't really stand them, you know. So we're just going to start this discussion. So, no.
Yeah. How then can it be right to say that our cities will never be freed from their evils until the philosophers, whom we admit to be useless to them, become their rulers?
Your question requires an answer expressed in a comparison or parable.
And you, of course, are not accustomed to speak in comparisons.
So you are making fun of me after driving me into such an impasse of argument. But, all the same, hear my comparison so that you may still better see how I strain after imagery. For so cruel is the condition of the better sort in relation to the state that there is no single thing like it in nature. But to find the likeness for it and a defense for them, one must bring together many things in such a combination as painters mix when they portray goat stags and similar creatures. Conceive this sort of thing happening either on many ships or on one. Picture a shipmaster in height and strength, surpassing all others on the ship, but who is slightly deaf and of similarly impaired vision, and whose knowledge of navigation is on par with his sight and hearing. Conceive the sailors to be wrangling with one another for control of the helm, each claiming that it is his right to steer, though he has never learned the art and cannot point out his teacher or any time when he studied it. And what is more, they affirm that it cannot be taught at all. But they are ready to make mincemeat of anyone who says that it can be taught. And meanwhile, they are always clustered about the shipmaster, importuning him and sticking at nothing to induce him to turn over the helm to them. And sometimes, if they fail and others get his ear, they put the others to death or cast them out from the ship. And then, after binding and stupefying the worthy shipmaster with mandragora or intoxication or otherwise, they take command of the ship, consume its stores, and, drinking and feasting, make such a voyage of it as it is to be expected from such. And, as if that were not enough, they praise and celebrate as a navigator, a pilot, a master of shipcraft, the man who is most cunning to lend a hand in persuading or constraining the shipmaster to let them rule, while the man who lacks this craft they censure as useless. They have no suspicion that the true pilot must give his attention to the time of the year, the seasons, the sky, the winds, the stars, and all that pertains to his art, if he is to be a true ruler of the ship. And that he does not believe that there is any, and that he does not believe that there is any art or science of seizing the helm with, or without the consent of others, or any possibility of mastering this alleged art, and the practice of it at the same time with the science of navigation. With such goings on aboard ship, do you not think that the real pilot would very indeed be called a stargazer, an idle babbler, a useless fellow, by the sailors and ships managed after this fashion?
Quite so.
All right. So, and later, Socrates points out that it's not, you have these idiots saying, you know, I want to steer the ship, but the problem is the only one that's qualified is the astronomer, is a stargazer, as he points out. And, you know, they think he's kind of crazy. You know, that's part of it. But it's not, see, the thing with Socrates points out, it's not the astronomer's fault that you have a bunch of idiots. It's just that these idiots don't actually know how to put this guy to use. And that is kind of the relationship for a while LaRouche has had to the population. But look, you have a problem with what the kind of characters people worship. And, you know, I just wanted to make fun of this. And, because I want people to take this seriously, right? What kind of people do people worship or deem is great? And let's just, can you put slide 12, it should be. Okay. All right, boost it up. Shoot it up. Oh, man. It's defective. Hold on. Oh, man, all the clips are gone. Okay. Look, apart from not knowing anything, this guy's not even real. But most people that you didn't get to the cadre school right now are probably watching this, and it's a problem. But or listening to Tupac is the same thing. Anyway, so let's see. Let's see. Now I do want to discuss the stargazer as someone necessary for humanity. Because look, that is important, and all this discussion earlier about the noosphere, you know, developing the human mind. It is true. You actually do have to develop the human mind, and so the person that we have to value, or the individual that we have to value, has to inevitably be wise. And so one of the problems one thing that's actually the case with any discovery, whether it's in math, science, any discovery, if it's valid, it's actually going to be valid forever. right? If you make a discovery in chemistry, it's not like in the next 5 minutes it's just totally useless or something, right? It may be improved upon as we see throughout human history, but any discovery will be valid forever. And so now I am going to discuss some of the, now I do want people to keep in mind this is very, I guess you can say, it's not super developed. None of us here are, you know, claiming to be the greatest scientists or anything. This is, we are beginners in this science. But first, before I go into the astronomy and these ideas, we want to take that down. We don't want to. Okay. I want to demystify astronomy because, first of all, how many of you, you know, always seeking for the smartest person, right? If you want to know about the stars, how many of you actually, like, instead of actually doing astronomy, looked up like your horoscope or something like that? Raise your hand. Just be honest. Yep. You have all these like, and it's funny because everyone knows like Scorpio and all blah blah blah. Look, a lot of this stuff is just, you know, certain stars around, that we're orbiting. And whenever we orbit, we see these stars along our orbit, the Earth. That's all that is. It determines when you're going to lose your job and get married or something like that. You know, this is, it's insane. So I want to do, so don't have this view. Can you put slide 11. All right, and then blast it. Ah, oh, 9. Okay. So crystal ball rubbing, you know, all this has to. You got to get that. Just throw it out. You know, get rid of, flush it down the toilet. All right. So let's actually get into some things. Okay. So like I was saying earlier, look, knowledge, you make a discovery about something, and it's going to be valuable forever, right? Now, if that's the case, then your relationship between other people is going to be totally different. You take the discovery of something like the phone or something, you know, that changes everything. It would be hell to get people to the cadre school writing letters, you know. So don't. That's not the kind of. So you need. That has a huge effect when you make that discovery. That's what it is. Now with that relationship, I'm gonna throw out a term that I want to keep coming back to, which is proportionality. That's what we're gonna discuss right now, in terms of that process, because. That is what it is. It's not, people think of proportions, they think of like, actually I don't want to say what people think. Let me see, what can we say as an example? Because I already know what people think. Alright, people think of maybe like my shirt, like I'll get a medium-sized shirt instead of a large shirt. So I don't know. Like that's a proportion or something. But we want to get it some more profound. Now, oh yeah, one more thing. This is just to kind of make it more coherent so I don't rant. Does everyone here acknowledge that, okay, we need wise people, knowledge, that's necessary? Right? Who says, no, we should be stupid beasts and live in with nature? And I wish I was the cow grazing. We saw a bunch of cows. All right. Okay, look, then that means, Then doesn't that mean that how these discoveries are made is important as well? Yeah. All right, so that's what we're going to discuss. We're going to discuss these two things, the proportionality itself, as well as the method in which these things are discovered. All right. So, no grievances. You should take that down, man. Don't leave it on for that long. Just take it down. Because look, I'm going to go way back in time. We're going to go way back. We're going to look at the Egyptians. And let's look at. First, I'm going to discuss rhined papyrus. Papyrus is a papyrus. Sorry. Damn you, grammarians! Are. That also just means paper. It does. His name is rhined paper. But okay. So we're going to go. This guy lived around 1700 BC. No, that's not him, man. Take that down. Take that down. Take it.
Sorry. Sorry.
This is why we need tyranny now, too. Okay, so. Okay, look. No. Look. Okay. All right, so. How many of you have heard, do unto one as you would do unto another? How many of you do that, but in a nice way? Not like, I'm mean, so I'm going to. Do unto one as you. Well, where'd you hear it? Bible school? How many heard it in Bible study? Raise your hand. Okay. Look. Think of how your approach with mathematics, right? People think math. Okay, we started with counting shit, right? We were like, yeah. One. This is one, two, three. I mean, that's totally insane. That's actually not. The way Greeks approach, I mean, excuse me, the Greeks, the Egyptians, in this case, would approach a math problem is through a principle, an idea. And so you take this idea of do unto one as you would do unto another, and let's actually look at it in terms of multiplying. We're gonna multiply numbers. Let's look at slide two. Okay. Whee, there you go. All right, bless. I hopefully won't get defective. All right. So, this is a simple proportionality. Now, for those of you who want to calculate it and are bored, you can do it. But it's right. It's mathematically right. You can test it out. First, we're gonna do an operation to one, right? You guys see that? We're gonna double it. Up to, we get to 32, then we're going to add, because, first of all, we're going to multiply 33 by 47. So, okay. We're going to apply this principle, do unto one as you would do unto another. Not in the Bible, but we're going to do it here. Now, let's look at the, hold on. Try to follow. Okay. 33 times 47. So we're gonna start with 1, and we're gonna get to 33 with that. Alright, you guys got that?
Yeah. Okay.
So the way we get that is we're gonna double 1, 2, 3, 4. Until we get to 32, then we're gonna add, see those little lines? The Egyptians, the line is adding, basically. So we add that and we get 33. You guys see that? We add 32 plus and 1, you get 33. After you do that. Now, the way they would multiply is they'd take 47, and actually you do the exact same thing you did to 1. See that? Doubled until you got to this time, because right here we doubled how many times? 1, 2, 3. How many times, class? One, two, three, four, five times. And then we added that fifth one to the first. So you do that same thing here, right? One, two, three, four, five. Add that. You get this. This is the answer.
All right, so... Let's see. What are we going to do now?
Okay, and this is just kind of one type of proportionality. Now let's look at... Now we're going to look at a shape, because numbers, to just look at numbers is kind of insane. So can you do, where the hell is it? Slide 6. Okay, so that's one type of proportionality. There's a relationship between that we created. Okay, now this is, and I wish I could have drew it better, but we're going to have to be happy. Is that what we're going to do is we're going to compare a line with a curve. This is a, it's kind of similar to what we did before, but we're because remember when I mean a proportionality, I'm talking about a very specific relationship that is created, right? And so what we did here is we inscribed the triangle in a circle, and we have a line here. And what I decided to do was cut that line evenly into four pieces with these radii. You guys see that? Okay. Now, the way you can set up this kind of proportionality is, you guys see that these are evenly four, right? But how is it, but what about the curve on the circle? You guys see how it's actually not even? All right, so that's another example of proportionality. So, all right, so we're going to look at one more thing, and then we're going to hopefully get more exciting. All right, can you put it on slide 5? Okay. Again, the drawing isn't great. It's not Da Vinci, but we'll. Okay, now, you guys all know the Egyptians built pyramids, right? Okay. Well, actually, I don't know if I know. We never went. We don't know. But, okay. Now, there's a proportionality set up here. And the way the Egyptians figured this out is they would have this very specific relationship that, and you got to kind of think of it as like, you know, I'm to my dad as my dad is to my grandpa. That's a type of proportionality. But we're gonna look at this. What they did is they got the height of the pyramid, which is this, is to the base, and if you can imagine this was a pyramid, and we flipped it over like this, and we got like the base of it, because the base is a square. The proportionality between this, they got a proportion that this is to the square as the square is to the circle. And I don't have like a mathematical calculation of it, but most people would probably. Now let me ask you guys, how do you think this was done? You guys think it's pretty simple? I could have done that. You?
Are you talking about in terms of area or like length of perimeter? The lengths.
Yeah, the lengths. Not area. Because the area of a height, I mean, what? All right. So, all right. Okay. So, now, because and go back to how knowledge is generated, right? Because we acknowledge that's important. Now the way the Egyptians did is someone didn't come up to them and say, here's this book. This is where all the truth in the universe is. And you'll find what proportion do you want? Oh, the height is to the perimeter. It's all right here. It's all in here. It's all here. It's in the back cover. Oh, let me look at the back of the book. Jesus Christ. Where is it? Oh. Or they just beat their head on it with the paper and compass, right? Ryan Papers is just like, he was just on this paper just cutting up things. And, no, that's totally irrational. What they actually did was they were stargazers. They actually went out and looked at the heavens around them, and that's really how you get these mathematical relationships. So first, now we're going to show real astronomers. Now you can kind of show Imhotep. Okay. So this is what real people that we need to actually, I wouldn't say idol. What's a good word? People that we should respect in society. You know, they look like this. You know, well, they don't look like that, but they're more along the lines of just, you know, an average person. They're not some strange individual. But his name is He Who Comes in Peace. So, what did he do? And actually, look, there's really, this is actually what LaRouche talks about. Because remember, we said, okay, you discover something, an idea, it's going to be valid forever. And a lot of these guys actually acknowledge that what they were doing in their mortal life was going to have a effect afterwards. You know, because that's the way they in other words, they understood this. And, you know, I've read a lot, some books, and they talk about how some of these pharaohs would be buried in boats, and they would travel after their death or something. You know, that's just kind of just like the mystical stuff that may have been part of the culture. But people like Imhotep understood that if you start, you know, discovering things and pass this down, you know, this is going to be useful. And so later pyramids that were built way after him, one in Giza that Mr. LaRouche talks about, there's an inscription that has a lineage of the you know, architects, stargazers, and it goes back to him, basically. So let's actually investigate this. So, all right. Okay. Now I want to read something by Mr. LaRouche real quick. Now can you actually put it on slide? What is it? It's 13. Okay. Sure. So this is by Mr. LaRouche. He said, okay. Someone asked him, well, about looking at stars. And this was Mr. LaRouche's response. He said, "You'd build a deep pit, a deep well, and if the well is narrowly fixed, you can actually see the stars during the daytime." Okay. And this is what the Egyptians did. Now these chambers, these kind of passages and things like that. It says here air shaft. I mean, that's absurd. These things actually helped view stars during the daytime, because if you have underground tunnels and things like that, you could actually. Well, actually, I don't know. We should try it. We should dig a pit throughout the weekend, see if. Actually, no, I'm not going to do it, you guys. All right, so, and you can see the stars during the day. Now, this is actually how you can start developing a sense of cycles. Astronomical cycles, which are definitely useful. And maybe some people can go through that throughout the week. But this is kind of a tool to actually watch the stars, map them out, and things like this, day and night. So they had a lot of real access to view the motion of the planet. And I'm kind of ashamed to show this because it got beat up along the way here, but it's kind of ghetto. But it makes a good point. So the way these pyramids were built was not through looking at this, right? It was actually more like looking at something like this. All right. So, as crude as it is, as unaesthetically pleasing as it is. Okay, now, look, and then I'm going to make a point about this. You have, say, there's a circle kind of going through this thing, like that. And then you had another one going that way. So this is actually how they developed different methods of mapping out stars, because what you had is stars will kind of, and you see the sun do this, right? So that's actually why they kind of had more like of a circular kind of motion, because they start rising at a certain point and then they reach like a maximum and then they go down, right? So that's what these lines represent, things like that. There's technical terms, but I just don't want to like give definitions. So we'll try to keep it in ideas. Now, I want you people to take a look at this. Kind of. Right. Now, what I want to do, and this is why I wanted people to be careful with this, because now you got a present for you. All right. Dun, 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 dun. This is much more elaborate, obviously. But if you look at it, fundamentally, if you really want to build this, you can actually use a much better construction than I did. But you can use this to actually create that lawfully. It's actually pretty much the same type of model. Now, which came first, the inscribing of the circles or the egg? I mean, excuse me, the solid, right? And that is. I would actually guess this. This. I gotta put it back now, so everyone wonder at it as it goes back. Anyways, you gotta kind of. Okay, that's how you gotta view the pyramid. You gotta view the pyramid from gazing at the stars. And okay, don't worry, we're almost done. I know everyone wants to go to sleep, but relax. Oh yeah, we got to view the comet and stuff. All right, now. Okay. Now, one thing is if you kind of, obviously the world doesn't revolve around us, but mathematically, just to make some points, you could, if you were to view this from the standpoint of kind of like you observing the heavens as if everything's kind of rotating around you in a sphere. Can you put up actually wait here. Can you put slide hold on. Just put slide 7 real quick. Okay. Actually, no. Put slide. Yeah, no. Put slide 8. Okay. So just imagine that you have your point of view, and you're in like a ball. and that's you right here.
Me.
All right. So right here, there's kind of this ball. Now the thing is, this is kind of how you can start developing different mathematical relationships. And one thing the Egyptians were able to do, because like I said, they can see the stars during the daytime and things like this. Now I'm trying to. Actually, no. Go back to slide 7. Okay. Now look, this is a more modern view of this. All right. So this is more like what we have today. Hey, keep it there. Okay. Now in a more elaborate thing, now we don't necessarily have like a pyramid that we build and things like that, but in terms of the Earth's motion, the Earth It doesn't just like move around the sun like this. Say that was the sun. Actually, it actually also will, like the top of it will start moving around like this. So as it's going like this, the top of it's going like that. I guess I'll hear you. That's what this is. This is actually from the standpoint of everything's revolving around us. But it does show this. There's like a separate. You guys see how there's like a separate orbit here, kind of the pole. That's actually what it is. So you have. So you have this whole thing rotating. Okay, so you have this whole thing rotating, and this part is rotating to the pole. Now, how did Imhotep and his buddies figure it out? Because, go back to the observer's point of view. And actually, go back to the pyramid. We can go back to the pyramid. Yeah. Okay. What they did was they aligned a passage, one of these underground passageways to a star. And, this is kind of like what they said they figured was the North Pole. And look, you'll start noticing, obviously, because these guys, you've got to realize, these people had knowledge that went back years. So they knew where things were. So as the passageway was aligned with the star. And they knew, they had a sense of cycles. Now, what if during that cycle, the star actually came off? It was off. You thought you had it aligned every year, but all of a sudden it started kind of like veering off, right? So that kind of gave them a sense that the pole itself is moving. Now, what did people like Imhotep do? This is now where Imhotep set up a proportionality between man and the universe, or God, or the fourth phase, or kind of a larger cycle than a human being. Because what he actually figured out is that if you were to look at this from a circle, like right here, what he figured out was that like 1 degree. This is 360. 1 degree is like 72 years of a mortal human being. So this is called precession, and so he figured out that 1 degree is 72 years. And so what he did was to figure out that whole cycle was do this proportionality. Now, we're going to do the same thing we did earlier with Ryan Papyrus. Can you go to slide 3? Okay, so he's setting up a proportion between me, or you, or a human being's life, to the gods, as they would say. And he got the number 25,920. Now, what I want to do is now what I want to do is actually show slide 4. Now, I want people to see. Actually, wait, not yet. Now, how many of you guys think that this simple math problem, like, it just seems kind of crazy? Because it's fairly simple, right? This multiplication thing. To figure out that whole cycle. Do you guys think he was like off? How off? Do you guys think he was just totally off? You know, this is elementary school.
What's the number?
25,920. Now go to slide 4.
Tell me, what is it referring to?
This is
the cycle.
This is how long it takes the pole to go around like this.
Okay. How many days?
Years.
Because remember, 72 years in for us is this.
Okay. Where did he get the number
72? That was the average lifespan. He also, his dad had records of They built. You got to realize they had tons of pyramids too. A lot of pyramids had similar kind of things to know where stars are. And stuff like that. All right, so this Imhotep, and he lived what, like 3000 BC? I forget. So this is Imhotep is his calculation of this whole cycle isn't really that off. I mean, look at he calculated 72 years. Today it's 71.6. You know, that's fairly. It kind of boggled me at the simplicity of this. So that's kind of the proportionality he set up between man and the universe. And you can put it back on him, I guess. Mm-hmm. Put it back on him. Yeah. Okay. All right, so I've been discussing all this, and look, just to kind of go into the next panelist, I just wanted to introduce something because, you know, this, it's not like this is only that this idea of proportionality is only going to be applied to some kind of mapping of when the Earth goes around. Is that this is actually something that can definitely be applied into a social process. And, you know, the challenge to everyone here is what proportionality are you setting up with other individuals in your lifespan? Because, you know, you're not like multiplying with someone or something. You're not like a number, simple number. But you do actually have an effect on others. You know, whenever you're in a conversation with someone, you have an effect on them. And it's not going to just have an effect with the time interval that you're speaking to them in, right? Like, I spoke to this guy for 5 minutes, I'm done talking to him, that's it. Especially if you develop an identity of historical proportions, right? Where, in fact, what you did will last for a long time. And that's actually why we're actually sitting here discussing someone like Imhotep. Is that that's actually how they started viewing themselves and their relationship with other human individuals. And so with that, we're going to introduce Scott Rusfold. No clapping.
Can you help me?
What are you looking for?
I just want to put my disc in. It's not loading up.
Did you put it in already?
Yeah. So Ricky kind of talked about the ancient astronomy of Egypt and proportion and all that, and that was very good. So I'm going to go forward in time about, I don't know, 2,800 years to 200 and something BC. Right? There was this guy that lived. His name was Eratosthenes.
First, I want to talk about what we've been doing as a group, the Spherics group of Oakland. You know, we've been reading the Earth's Next 50 Years paper and going through, just reading it and working on the ideas in it pretty hard, but they're good and it's necessary for civilization. So what we're going to do is, what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to try to give a presentation that's hopefully going to embody something in that paper. Because what it goes through is it goes through how do we develop a dialogue of civilizations, a dialogue of cultures that spans generations, right? It just keeps going. It like a self-reflexive, self-growing process. How do we develop that, you know, as a species? Something like that. So, you know, obviously you think of that, you think of the Pleiades, right? You know, this thing, these things, you know, these stars have been looked at for, I don't know, as far back as we can pretty much see. And you got Egypt, right? You got India, you got China, these ancient civilizations. But there's actual documented proof that they had temples and pyramids and things like this oriented towards the stars on certain, you know, nights or whatever. Or when the sun would rise at a certain spot on a certain day, you'd have an opening at a certain temple and the light would come through. So you had these types of advanced cultures that go back thousands of years. So how is it that it can reach us, you know, in 2005 AD, you know, February 4th, 2005. How is it that spanned all that time, right? And we can still look at it and we can still understand and develop on those principles that these people discovered. How is it that we're able to do that? And how that they were able to transmit, you know, it gets into like language and culture, right? You have to have a necessary culture that's based on ideas in the human mind and based on the principle that you can know principles. Right? Based on the idea that you can know principles and you can employ them in your civilization to better your civilization. You can do that. And that's what we want to do as a youth movement, right? As a cultural, you know, organization, as a you know scientific organization, a musical whatever, right? We want to employ those principles that have advanced humanity this far in civilization and advance on those principles. So tonight we're going to look at this. It's going to be kind of cool. It's not going to look like that. So don't get all romantic. Oh, it's going to look like a fuzz of green in the sky. That's it. Maybe. So we're going to look at that and, you know, we look at all this stuff. This is ancient Egypt. Right, I'm going to talk about Eratosthenes. LaRouche has mentioned him a lot. You know, he's made great discoveries. He was a scientist, an astronomer, you know, geographer, you know, mathematician. He wrote several treaties. Most, if not all, of them are lost to antiquity. It's a tragedy, but it's true. That, you know, probably, you know, the Library of Alexandria got burned down. It probably had a lot of these writings back in, you know, shortly after Christ lived and died. So that's Eratosthenes. He's bald. He's old. So what did he do? He had a simple problem, right? Because everybody up until that time, up into his time, was
They had no idea what was going on with the planet. They didn't know if it was round. They didn't know if it was, you know, a cube. They didn't know if it was a cylinder. They didn't know what the hell it was. So he came up with a hypothesis. He was in Egypt. And he said, well, I'm going to hypothesize that it's a sphere. Gigantic, it's a sphere. Right? So he made an experiment. He did an experiment based on that hypothesis. And I'm going to kind of go through that. Here. So he lived in Alexandria, which is in the top left of your screen. And then he you know, worked for the library at Alexandria that held hundreds of thousands of ancient manuscripts until it got burned down by the Romans. So, and what he had is he had been to Syene, which is down here in Lower Egypt, and he knew the distance between Alexandria and Syene. So for this experiment, he's like, okay, I know that the distance between these two cities is 490 miles. You know, our measurement of a mile. It's sort of like 250,000 stadia, which is like 800 feet, is one stadium, something like that. So he knew that it was 490 miles, you know, our time, our measurement. So I'm going to kind of write this up. Okay, so
he's the software.
That's fine. Alexandria and one called Syene at the time. Now it's called Aswan. This is a black pen. That was a good pen. Oh, it's deep. Alright, so here. I'm just going to draw it. You got the meridian lines, Aswan, and how it kind of comes up. It goes out here. Okay. Alexandria is over here, Syene is down here. Right? So what he did was he came at it from a hypothesis that okay, the world is a sphere, right? So if it's a sphere, then there's got to be circles, you know, circumferencing the sphere. So he did this. Okay, here's the Earth. Right? Pretend like that's a circle. Here's the sun. The shining rays, right? Rays. And he knew that on the summer solstice, at noon, on the meridian line at Syene, that the sun would be straight up, right, at the zenith, which is directly straight up. So he had a deep well at Syene, right? That's pretty deep, huh? Yeah. So the deep well is here, you know, to the core, not steam. But anyway, so there's a deep well, and the light shines straight down without touching the walls of the well. It just went straight down. You know. No shadow at all at that portion, at that place. And he had up at Alexandria an obelisk sticking out of the earth, right? About, I don't know, 50 feet tall or something. It doesn't matter really how tall, but it was something that was making a shadow on the same day. And he's like, well, if the earth was flat, imagine this. The earth is flat, right? There's a deep well here, no shadow. There's an obelisk. If it was flat, would this have a shadow?
No.
Okay. This wouldn't either, right? So if it was flat, there would be no shadow, right? So that's one thing. He's like, okay. You know, that's a paradox, right? So there's a shadow. And it was I think seven. Yeah. The shadow had an angle, or it had a. What was it? Hang on. Oh yeah. The angle is 7.2 degrees here. And he knew that a circle has 360 degrees. So, knowing the calculation, right, you have 7.2 degrees. You have 360 degrees. So he did this. 360 degrees divided by 7.2. Any math majors in here? What's that? Come on, Pop. It's 50. I think. Yeah, 50. I did the calculus, 50. So, this, so 1/50th of the circumference of the Earth is 490 miles.
Right?
So, this takes some brain power, right? You gotta think and concentrate. Because, you know, numbers and all that. So 1/50th of, wait, so 490 times 50, right? Disagreeing people throw a tomato at me or something? Okay. No, that's right. 490 times 50. You know, 204, you know, about it, right? 24,000 miles. You know, keep in mind that he had a different measurement because in ancient Greek times they had what's called stadia, which is about 800 feet, and this was 250,000 stadia. So he did the same pretty much thing except 250,000 times 50. I didn't calculate that. But in our measurements would be about 24,000 miles. So he's like, okay. Yeah. The circumference of the Earth is 24,000 miles approximately, right? Or 24,500. Right, because of this. So we did that. It's pretty close. The circumference of the Earth is about 25,000 miles, right? So he did that. That's Heraclitus, by the way. Pretty cool guy. Using that, using what Eratosthenes did, this is the next portion. There was this guy in Egypt. Yeah.
You said that he saw the shadow on the same day?
Well, he had a friend. This is my hypothesis. He had a friend in the correspondence, and they set up an experiment on the summer solstice. And that happened. Noon.
Well, but then he wouldn't actually need to measure anything on the equator, right?
It's not the equator, it's on the meridian line.
Yeah, but I'm saying you don't need to be at the well.
You need to stay in club.
If you know at what time the sun will be right above it, you need to measure the shadow, you know. You know
well, the thing is the thing is, this proves the fact that it's like a slight curve, right? Like, because you need to have both. Because if you don't have both, it's stupid. Because you need this one because it's straight up and down. You need this one because if it was flat, there'd be no shadow. That's why you need it.
All right,
okay. So, for now, we'll talk later. For the means of the presentation. So, using that, there was this guy. I guess got a commission from the Pharaoh, who I'm not sure who was at the time, Ptolemy something, I think the second or the third, who went from the Nile, there was a canal, they dug a canal to the Red Sea, which is where that is, and out, and actually sailed in ships like that in about 232 BC. They sailed looking for, you know, gold and I don't know, whatever you need, you know, silk, you know, clothes for stuff and stuff. They traveled and they generally knew, you know, around the Indian coast, they generally knew that area. This place in McClure Bay in like Indonesia, they generally had a good idea about that place. They had been there before and they'd you know, been with them. But using Eratosthenes, using a map that he did, and using his discoveries, they were able to go navigate farther. They just went out. They just took off, right? And they went out, and they traveled across the Pacific Ocean. You know, and they had a tool that was called the Tanawa. Yeah, yeah, and these types of boats, big one-sail boats, right? Yeah. Yeah, across the Pacific. And they had about a flotilla, I guess, that's what it says in the thing, six boats.
Big boats.
Not like, it looks like a little regatta thing, but big, heavy-duty boats. Probably hundreds of, you know, or maybe like 100 or more sailors, right? So they traveled across the Pacific Ocean. In 200 BC, 230 BC, 1700 years before Columbus. Before Columbus. So this is ancient Greek times. That's freaking cool, right? Because ancient times, you have people traveling across the ocean, right? Before, you know, and then later, for some reason, you know, you got back to this idea that the world is flat. After they had already done this, right? What if you know? So they went across, they landed about in Central America somewhere. They went up and down the coast about 4,000 miles, and there was they found cave inscriptions with Egyptian writing, right? This guy Barry Fell in the 50s and the 60s translated this stuff. He found out that it's ancient Cyrenaican, which is in like northern Egypt. Ancient Libyan Cyrenaican inscriptions in places like Santiago, Chile, Pitcairn Island. Apparently there was a shipwreck after they came back down. They left at Santiago. There was a shipwreck because they found wreckage and writings in Pitcairn Island of this voyage. You know, the mentioning Maui and his you know, conquests and things like this. I'm talking about the Pharaoh, right, way out there in the Pacific. So that happened, 232 BC, right? I just think that's freaking cool that they were able to do that. And then you had this huge expanse of time, 1,700 years, where they couldn't do that. Like, you take somebody in the year 500 AD, 600 AD, up to 1492 AD, you don't have these kinds of conquests in that time period. Why not? Anybody think why not?
Rome.
Okay. Yeah, you did. You had a collapse. Somebody said it. You had a collapse of culture, right? In Egypt, you had this type of culture, scientific, you know, very oriented towards the human mind. That you can actually know things about the universe and employ them in society and civilization to better all of humanity, right? You knew, they knew certain things that were lost, that got lost up until Columbus's time, because you had deployments, explicit deployments, people like Aristotle, people like Ptolemy, Copernicus, Galileo, who deliberately lied or were just idiots. Who claimed that, oh, you know, the earth is flat and, you know, you're going to fall off and this and that, right? So, and you had, you know, collapse of civilization for 2,000, you know, 1,500 years. So, those kinds of things happen. And that's kind of what we got to stop, is that. And we have to promote is a culture kind of like what was sung, right? And actually from a scientific standpoint, right? You know, from that kind of standpoint. So what you have are these ancient civilizations, right? That do that. No, okay, so you take it way back. You take it way back. Talking about like 10,000 BC. You had an ice age. The ice age was ending. So, glaciers start melting, right? So you have coastlines that you have a lot of cities on coastlines because obviously you have people sailing, right? You have these peoples of the sea that people that LaRouche keeps mentioning, you know, that have sailed into through the Straits of Gibraltar into northern Africa instead of, you know, those civilizations. So what happened was you had the Ice Age melts. It drowns all these civilizations. So one thing I wanted to go through was how did that happen and how do we stop that? But I'm not going to do that next time. I wanted to really get into is this idea of navigation. How do we get to do that voyage? Yeah. So what I was talking about was Eratosthenes and Maui's voyage. Okay. So what we're doing as a group, as an organization, as a cadre of leaders, and what the purpose of this weekend is to create an environment, is to create a culture in the United States, in the world, that Eratosthenes and Plato and Socrates and Da Vinci and LaRouche would be proud of. So because we can advance civilization, we can advance humanity in become more in line with what the universe dictates, really. Like if we want to go there, if we want to go there and look at the Earth from there, from Orion, you have to necessarily do something that the universe agrees with. We have to develop the necessary science. We have to develop the necessary, propulsion. I don't know, things like this. To get there, right? Like right now, the furthest that human beings have gone is like to the moon and back. But what we have is we have probes. We have a probe on the Titan, on Titan. Saturn's moon, Titan, right? That's you know, scooting around up there, doing stuff. So if you want to go there, you should find out, you should, you know, come to know more about the human mind. And actually, how do you bring your actions and your way of thinking more in congruence with the universe? That's kind of it. But I don't know, is there any, Sylvia's going to talk now. And then there'll be questions, and then we're going to go look at a comet.
No clapping yet. We have banned the clap.
Okay. So I just wanted to reflect on what Ricky was talking about with this idea of proportions. Can everybody hear me? Okay. All right. Yeah. All right. Because this idea of doing unto others as you would do unto one, the proportions. I mean, like he said, where do people hear this? They hear it from, you know, school or Bible study or something. But we're actually looking at it from all the way back into the Egyptian period. We're actually discovering where this idea, this concept really comes from. And then, if just like Scott went through this idea of Eratosthenes, I mean, most of the population today, if you were to ask them, especially on the campus universities, I'm just going to push this back. Even in the science departments, even teachers, if you were to ask them about this experiment of discovering the circumference of the Earth, most teachers today would not even know about that. I mean, there has been, you know, very few people have even done this experiment. I myself have not even done this experiment. But I do know of a person who did do the experiment for a science project, and the teacher was just, whoa, what is this? So what does that say? What does that say about our civilization? How are we going to create a culture that can produce individuals like that, like Imhotep or Eratosthenes or Archimedes or any of these other people? Because if we don't, we're heading into a collapse of civilization. And I don't mean a collapse of civilization like you're going to lose just, access to, your pleasures per se, but a collapse of civilization where the human species is not going to exist as a human being, as a productive, creative individual. But you will be, human beings will be resorting to their acting like animals, even though they are not animals, acting with their instincts. So what? How do you create? How did we get to this point where we don't have these type of individuals? You have this idea of the financial establishment, the financial oligarchy, which in order for them to have power, they have to find a way to dumb down the population. So you have people actually thinking about, well, all we really need is 5% of you to be educated. And the rest of you should be slaves. You should work at Walmart. You should work at, U.S. WorldComp, USA. All these service places where you're just not using your mind. And the way that they actually enslave you is not, because some people actually think that they want to work at these places. So that the way that they enslave you is that they shackle you with having these false assumptions, thinking that success is just having the ability to buy what you want, to have that you're well with your family. Your family looks at you as, oh, he's successful. He can buy a car, he can buy a house. This is the kind of measurement that we have today for society of being successful, is just being able to buy what we want when we want it and not being able to actually produce something. Produce something that's going to enhance our existence as a whole. So let's look at this period that Eratosthenes lived through, because this idea that you have this trip, like Scott just reflected on or just mentioned, this trip that the Egyptians took to Maui. I hadn't seen this picture of the ships earlier until now. And if you looked at the design of these ships, they were probably created to be traveling through the ocean for probably years, probably to sustain a whole culture even. It takes a certain kind of thinking to be able to produce something like that, even back then. And then you have this trip that it took to Chile, where it was documented in paintings in the caves. And a lot of these paintings, we can look back today, I think in Germany there were some that were found. And they're very developed. They're very developed paintings. They're not stick figures or anything very banal. And then you also have, I think, the discovery of some kind of like arrows that were, or spheres. I'm not sure of the exact date, but I'm thinking like 600,000 BC. That's pretty far back. And they look like they were mass produced. So they're not like just one person making a few spheres, but there had to be some kind of a method created within the culture itself to be able to mass produce these spheres so that people can hunt and sustain themselves. So this trip actually took place 232 BC. The next time you had a voyage like that, a transoceanic voyage, was 1492. And as Scott, asked earlier, what happened? Yeah, there was a collapse. There was a collapse of civilization. There wasn't any progress. There was probably a collapse of the physical economy. There was probably this idea of man just sustaining himself through his bestial instincts. These groups ravaging the land and just pillaging, trying to survive. This kind of thing for 1,600 years. This is what you had in civilization, 1,600 years. Think about it. And then think about today. What do we have right now? You have a president who's degenerate, who's you know, unqualified to govern this republic. And how many people actually think about what it took, what did it take to allow that to happen? Because you really got to look at each one of yourselves. What is it that you were doing or were not doing that allowed such a incompetent human being to right now govern one of the most important republics on the planet, in fact, the only republic that exists on the planet? So all you people that said, I didn't vote for Bush, that's not enough. You really got to reflect at the culture that we have. So you have a president who's making decisions, and many of us, I'm sure a lot of us have organized, you know, on the street, on the campuses. We meet regular people. You get a lot of this stuff where people say, I hate Bush, I hate Bush. And people don't even know why. They just hate Bush because he's doing some horrible things, but they think he actually runs the country. He's not making the decisions. He doesn't even know where his decisions or his opinions come from. He's actually shackled by this degenerate culture that we have. After 30 years of post-industrial society, this is what you have. And how many people in the population today that are not Bush actually think like Bush without even knowing it? I mean, we meet him on the street all the time. The beast man comes out. John Craig could tell you about a story, you know? But the thing is, we can't allow ourselves to be governed by our opinions. We have to really dig deep and look at the actual assumptions, the actual axioms by which we're making decisions. And even ourselves, you know, in this political movement, I mean, we tend to sometimes fall into, I myself as well, make decisions based on our current emotion or our current state of mind or mood of mind at the moment. And we have to keep, you know, checking ourselves all the time, because it is true, like Scott said, if we are going to create a culture that can reproduce these type of voyages like we had here earlier, we have to really see how important we are. That we can't just, you know, waste time. So this, I started looking at this idea of a shockwave, and I know that there's going to be a presentation, I think, tomorrow on it, the shockwaves. So I'm not going to really go too deep into it. I just want to go through a little bit of the concept for this reason. I guess it was discovered because it was this idea of building aircraft that could go the speed of sound, that would travel the speed of sound. And normally planes or aircraft were just shaped with like a rounded kind of nose. And they started discovering problems because you started having ships disappear. They started, you know, there was accidents. Sometimes you would have a whole plane shattered, like a physical, like just shattering of it. And people were wondering, what the hell's going on? You had this certain kind of a phenomena that the plane would try to reach the sound barrier, but it wasn't able to penetrate through. So then it would just be destroyed. It's like a physical situation or something physical barrier was created. Now this German physicist Adolf Bussmann, he actually figured out that what was happening is that as the plane or the aircraft was trying to move forward, you would have these airways or like these kind of like waves that would, or actually air that would push out in the front, and it would create these waves, what they call the propagation of waves, something similar to that. I'm sure it's a little bit more detailed, but a series of waves that would propagate. And as the aircraft was trying to reach this the speed of sound, it actually ended up catching up to these waves. So this would create a sort of, I guess like a little, like if you, I don't have a picture of it on the, but I'm sure tomorrow they're going to see it. But I'm sure a lot of you guys have probably seen this picture of a plane. I mean, because we had things set up at the previous conference in cadre schools. It's like a little cloud, and the plane is going right through it. Actually, it's not in here. But I'm sure you're going to see it tomorrow. So it looks like there's this physical, actual cloud barrier, and the plane is trying to get through it, and it can't. Because of the way that it's designed, it doesn't allow it to penetrate. There's this kind of physical obstacle. And so this guy, Busman, decided to design these aircrafts with a needle and more of a pointed nose. And then they were able to get through. So what does that say? I mean, discovery of being able to use even just this idea of a design to be able to penetrate through something physical. This actually, you know, saved a lot of people's lives. And in America, they took a longer time to design these aircrafts that way because there was just a lot of this, the financial oligarchs, the bankers wanted to make money. So they didn't want to, like, take a new design and have to, you know, redesign, you know, make these new aircrafts. So this is one of the results of the type of degenerate culture that we have of a society which thinks that making money is profit instead of allowing the existence of human beings so that they can continue to make progress. They can continue to make discoveries, which is what the real wealth of a human being is. So we have this situation right now where we're either going through or we're about to hit a boundary in our civilization because we're not, with the current tools that we have, the current advancements that we have, the current kind of thinking of the average citizen that we have is not sufficient to deal with the actual world collapse that we are now in the process of living through. This collapse of the world financial system, which has a lot to do than just with money. It has a lot to do with just your everyday life. Turning on the light switch. Walking out in the street on a sidewalk. Using transportation. Going to using the water. You know, running the water. This is what the physical economy is. If you destroy that, you're killing people's lives. And this has been going on for 30 years currently. Not to mention, you know, the previous years. So this is what we're heading into right now, is that we can't even sustain our own population, let alone the future population. Like we talked about, the next 50 years, we're not going to be able to sustain them unless we have a shift, unless we have a change, unless we discover a way to design our thinking and our actions to be able to penetrate through that barrier that we have right now. But we actually have one good thing about us that's going to really help. And that's the fact that we are human beings and that we are not animals, because animals have a different ability than human beings to actually exist and to deal with their environment. The human being has a certain quality of mind they can actually generate something that is untouchable. This idea, like if you ever have an idea in your mind, you can't touch it, you can't taste it, you can't see it. But when you actually take that idea and you implement it into the physical realm, apply it into society, like a machine tool design, or even the discovery of a chair, which you're sitting on right now, then it actually affects the way people exist. If you look at the mind of somebody like Imhotep, I mean, you know, he actually had a father who had done some studies earlier on these cycles, but, I mean, just think about the way he situated himself. I'm going to continue the work that previous people before me did to discover what are these lights that we see in the sky? What is this? How does the universe exist? You know, they designed these pyramids because there was generations and generations of human beings that were charting these cycles that we can have access to today. It took hundreds and thousands of years. And so he situated himself in an actual intention for the future. And this is exactly what LaRouche is doing right now with building the youth movement. How are we going to create a type of culture where a generation, you know, 18 to 25 and even more, can start becoming productive, contributing citizens to the overall existence of the next 50 to 100 to 1,000 years of human beings? And these individual people, like Imhotep, I'm just referencing them because these are the people that you heard about today, but you will be hearing about many more tomorrow. They're still alive today. Because as they were trying to figure out and fight through the obstacles in their day, the obstacles in their own mind, in their own culture, you know, what they had in mind, even to be wanting to do that, had to be the future. They had to be thinking about you, even if they didn't meet you. How many of you actually, you know, came to this cadre school thinking that it's not going to result in something for the next week, the next year, that, you know? How many of you just made a blind decision and said, I feel like going to Cambria, I have nothing better to do, I'm bored. Raise your hand if that's the case. Really? Well, we hope to change that. Because the idea is that this cadre event is to, I mean, most people actually came because we actually worked hard on them. We worked hard on trying to have axiom busting sessions. And you could probably talk to Charlie if you want to know more about that kind of stuff. But just because I know Charlie, but I'm sure a lot of other people are like that as well. But no, seriously, I mean, most people don't come to these cadre schools just like that. It really takes a lot of really getting under their skin at what is your existence about? What are you going to do? I mean, like, you know, Ricky said, you're going to watch SpongeBob. I mean, I didn't even know who that was until he brought it up. That's how out of tune I didn't know who that guy was. I just, you know, I'm not into that. I mean, it's good to know sometimes what people are into just so you can go back into the cave and pull them out. But yeah, I wasn't really up on that one. But seriously, I mean, there's a lot of people, like, you know, I know a few people here. I'm not going to say their names, but, you know, all day, you know, we were just organizing them, ideas, and this is how we got most people to come. It wasn't because of the beach down the street, you know? So, yeah. And so this idea that these people are still alive today, we're actually living off of their ideas right now. Their future, what they did to discover different changes in the universe, different ways of understanding the universe that they live in, for their future is now our present. So we're looking back into the past, which was their future, to see where do we get our present from today. And this idea that LaRouche has about the next 50 years, this is really cool because it's not about 50 years, you know, like, you know, a year from now, what are we going to do, like, you know, every year? No, it's like really having this kind of like, like an overarching view. Like when you're singing the piece, like Abram, you know, you have to really have the whole piece in your mind. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to sing it. You got to have the whole idea in your mind. And this is the way the universe works. You have to have this intention. Another thing that I was thinking about is this idea of orbits. I mean, how many of you think the orbits are created by the planets? Well, how do you have orbits? Why is it that the planets revolve around the sun in an elliptical orbit? What's causing that? Besides gravity, but what is it? Is it gravity because the planets, you know, are gravitating in this, you know, orbital cycle, or in this orbit, or what's causing the cycle to exist? Actually, what you have is the orbit itself is actually pulling the planets in its motion. There's an actual existing orbit, an existing already predetermined guidance, intention, I guess you could say. And and you can't really like pinpoint it either, because at each moment that it's going around, you really can't say, okay, this is the speed it's going, because it's non uniform, constant change. And that's exactly what's, you know, pulling these planets. But if you look at animals, animals have they exist because they have instinct. You know, the beaver today, you know, will build a dam. A beaver 1,000 years ago built a dam. But doesn't know why it built a dam. The orbit itself doesn't know why it has this intention in which it's guiding these planets. There's something even higher than that. And I'm sure that, you know, that's this fourth phase space idea, which, you know, will probably be developed even more tomorrow. So how do we create a culture now that's going to allow us to supersede the kind of discoveries that have been made already in the past, that we've had a lot of collapses of civilization, a lot of dark ages, many that were small, that weren't very visible or weren't very like well known, but you've had these dips. And if you look at the population chart, you have these dips in population too. So how are we going to create the kind of discoveries that are going to ensure that this time we don't have to go through a dark age, that we can actually bypass a collapse of civilization, which is right now pending over us? You have, like I said earlier, you have a human being. And the human being, because he has this higher power, does not have to be bounded by instinct and does not have to be bounded by an orbit like the planets are. The human being can actually outdo the orbit of the planet. It can actually outdo this idea of an orbit. You guys get that? Like the human being isn't, even though there's a higher intention guiding a human being as well, there's still this free will that exists. You have the free will to do wrong. You have the free will to do good, but it's still free will, and you choose. But what you choose is going to determine the outcome of not only your own existence, but the existence of millions of other people. So what is it about that power of a human being? I mean, what does a human being have that makes them so special? Does anybody have any idea, like, off the bat? What makes you special? Huh?
Creative power.
Okay. Yeah. The creative power. Human beings can create out of nothing. Like I said, you know, they have this ability to create an idea that you can't touch, and yet it's a physical, you can implement it. You can actually discover, like Scott said earlier, the laws of the universe. You can have a lawful way of actually taming nature, which a lot of people have been brainwashed against. This idea of human beings being able to intervene into nature, that this is a taboo. You're going against Gaia, Mother Earth, right? And a lot of people, when they think about astronomy, they have these weird ideas, like Ricky brought earlier about a horoscope. They have this idea about superstition. You know, like in the old days, people were superstitious when they saw comets. They used to think it was fire burning, you know, like the end of the world is coming, right? You have these ecology movements that were created to make science a taboo, to make it like science is bad. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of people here don't even recognize that, but that you probably have a little bit of that within you, this kind of a cultural damage of the ecology movement that says, oh, you know, nature's beautiful, but man's destroying it, right? But human beings actually plant a lot of trees, by the way, so they wouldn't be here if it wasn't for human beings. So, and we make lakes and things like that. So I wanted to go through that idea of the uniqueness of a human being, but one more thing I wanted to add to enhance that, I know it's kind of late, is this poem by Schiller called Pegasus and the Yoke. And it's going to reflect a very profound metaphor, which is going to, and this idea that I had. I'm just going to read it because explaining it doesn't really do it justice. It's not that long. Okay. Perhaps it was to Haymart, a horse's mart, where other things into commodities were changing, that once a hungry poet brought the muse's steed to be exchanging. A hippogriff did neigh so bright, and in parade did prance with pomp so pretty. Astonished stood each one and cried, "The noble kingly animal, but pity that doth an ugly pair of wings its figure fair deform." The fastest mail train were gracing. The breed, the people say, is rare. Yet who will through the air be racing? And no one will his coin be placing. At last a daring farmer stood. "The wings, indeed," says he, "not useful does one find them. Yet one can always either clip or bind them. Then is the horse for pulling ever good. A 20 pound on this to risk I'm willing." The shyster, much amused, the wares now cheaply selling, agrees at once. "One man, one word." He sold the thing. And Hans trots with his booty freshly forward. The noble beast is now in yoke restrained, yet feels it scarce the burden so unwonted. Then runs it forth with flight, desires undaunted, and flings from noble wrath inflamed to chasm's edge all that the cart contained. "All right," thinks Hans, "I may be to this beast confiding alone no cart. Experience doth cunning make. Come morn will passengers be riding. I'll hitch you to the cart, the lead to take. Two horses shall this lively crab for me be saving, and with the years will fade its raving." At first it went quite well. The lightly winged horse enlives the old nag's step, and swift the cart is flying. But now what's this? With one look at the clouds turned course, and customed not the ground with solid hoof to plying, forsaken soon the safer cart wheel trail, and true to nature's stronger hail, it runs clear through the swamp and moor, tilled field and hedges. In equal frenzy doth the entire post steam seize. No call doth help, no rein its haste doth ease. At last, to wanderers' fearful ledges, the wagon, smashed apart from endless jolts, on steepest summit of the mountain halts. "That just is not the right way ever," says Hans, his face contorted much by doubt. "Thus will it be successful never. Let's see if this mad dog be brought through meager food and work to tether. The trial will be made. Soon beast with beauty rare, before 3 days did fade around it, the shadow was reduced. I have now found it," cries Hans. "Now quick, and hitch it here, before the plow beside my strongest steer." 'Tis said, 'tis done. In ludicrous procession, one sees on plow an ox and winged stallion. Unwilling mounts the griff and strains with final might its sinews forth to take as old to flying. In vain deliberate doth the neighbor stride, and Phoebus' steed so proud to steer must be complying. Till now, consumed by long resistant course, the strength from all its limbs is thinning. From grief now breaks the noble godly horse, to earth it falls and in dust is spinning. "Accursed beast!" at last breaks Hans' abuse, loud scolding out, whilst from him flies a beating. "So you then err, for plowing are no use. The rogue sold you to me was cheating." While yet in him doth rage of anger last, the whip doth swing, comes cheerful now and fast, a merry fellow on the road with footsteps fleeting. The zither sounds forth in his nimble hand, his hair, an ornament of yellow, is plaited through with golden band. "Where to that pair astonishing, my fellow?" he calls the peasant from afar. "The bird and ox a single rope is binding. I ask you, what is the pair? If for a while you'd be confiding the horse to make a test to me, look out, you shall a marvel see." The hippogriff unyoked doth stand, and smiling now the young man swings upon its haunches. The beast scarce feels the master's certain hand, then gnashes it the bridle band, and climbs, and lightning flashes from inspired glances. No more the former creature, kingly wise, a god, a spirit doth arise, unfurls it suddenly with stormy splendor, its winged pomp shoots roaring to the sky. And for a glance can follow nigh, it glides into the high blue yonder. So this idea of Pegasus, the winged horse, when it was put to practical use to carry goods, it wasn't able to do a good job. It broke everything. When it wanted to use it to be able to carry a carriage, he wasn't able to do it. Then he was put to slave labor, pulling the plow, and he wasn't able to do it. And he was very miserable because he was a special kind of horse. He was a winged horse. And he wasn't made for, practical things on the planet, on Earth. He was supposed to be the kind of stallion that could fly up into the heavens. And so I compare that metaphor to the metaphor of a human being. That a human being, when it's underdeveloped, it's miserable. Whether people know it or not, people when they're not developed, they're miserable. When they don't have access to beauty, they're miserable. Beauty such as great classical composition, or like this beautiful music that we heard earlier, or like or access to knowledge of discoveries like the ones that we just discussed today. So it's in the nature of human beings to be able to fly out to the heavens and do the impossible, like we went into the moon. This was the impossible, and we were able to do that. Because there's something special about human beings in which they are not bounded by any kind of orbit or any kind of instinct or any kind of culture. Even if you have a degenerate culture, you can still break out of it. And if anybody's ever read On the Sublime, especially a current translation by Pat Noble, On the Sublime by Schiller, he has this idea of no man is forced to must. That not even human beings have to must. They have the right to choose. Even death. Even death, you can choose. Because if you've lived a well life, if you've actually been productive in your life, if you've done with your life everything that you could to enhance the next generations to come, then you're not going to be afraid of dying. And so we have to break out of our current boundaries that each and every one of us has, and I'm sure that a lot of them are going to be provoked over the weekend. So you should look forward to it. You should look forward to having some good, discussions on exposing your axioms and your boundaries, and being able to create a new design of thinking to be able to break through. And that's what this movement actually represents. Which is, why, we're even considering doing a panel on the next 50 years. Because this is what we plan, each and every one of us, to be able to do in the future. To be able to become teachers of teachers. Producing new teachers that are going to produce even more teachers. So that was pretty much the idea that I had to finish up the panel with. If there's any questions... Okay, I don't know if you guys are too tired, but you can take this home if you want to try it. But this is in the Spherix, Orbita Ceres, Fidelio, is this idea where you can actually create your own orbit. Everybody knows about conic sections? Yay. Yeah? Are you guys going to talk about it tomorrow? Conic sections? Is there anybody doing conic sections? The slices of a cone, which create a circle or ellipse, hyperbola. Anyways, I cut out these squares that are wax paper. They got a circle on them. If people want to generate their own orbit and see what it's like, they could do it. You can, if you put a point in the middle, if you create a center, which you divide it into four parts, right? And you fold the circumference around the edges of the circle to the point, you can create the shape of a circular orbit. If you put the point away from the center, you'll create the shape of an ellipse. If you put a point outside the circle and you keep folding the circumference of the circle to that point outside the circle, you'll create a hyperbola. Yeah. And I'm not sure how to do the parabola. Maybe Shauna can do it. But anyway, so if anybody wants to try this, I have plenty. And you could take it, do it in your cabins. But we're probably going to go do this.
We're going to go to the ocean because it's like right down the street. And we're going to look...
If the comment's still out, we're going to see it.
I'm sure.
It's pretty late. It's 12.
It's 11:30. Maybe I'll just have these in the rec room or something, have them for pedagogy later on. Did you want an orbit?
Can I explain that again?
Sure, yeah. I know I was in a hurry.